Arvind ki jai. Namacharya Srila Haridas Thakur ki jai. Prem shikau Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Dvaita Gadadhar Shri Vasadi Gaur Bhaktavrinda ki jai. Shri Shri Radha Krishna Go Gopinath Shyamakunda Radha Kunda Giri Govardhana ki jai. Vrindavan Dhamma ki jai. Mathura Dhamma ki jai. Navadvipa Mayapur Dhamma ki jai. Jagannath Puri Dhamma ki jai. Gangamai Jumuna Devi ki jai. Bhakti Devi ki jai. Tulsi Maharani ki jai. Samaveta Bhaktivrinda ki jai. Gaur Premananda. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya. Krishna Prasaya Bhutale Srimati Bhaktivinoda Swami Niti Namane Namaste Saraswati Devi. Gauravani Pacharani Nivasesis and Nivani Paskachadi Satarani Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Utapadkamalam Sri Guru Vaishnavamscha Sri Rupam Sagrutatam Sahagana Raganatam Vitam Sam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Padijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lolita Sri Vishakam Vitamscha Banchakapa Chubishchaki Pasnuyavatap Teachanam Pavanavio Vaishnavam. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
June 15, 2015 in Perth, Australia. We're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3. Chapter 7, further increased by Vidura, text 31. Pashandapata Vishamyam Pratilomna Viveshanam Jivasya Gatayo Yascha Yavatir Guna Karmaja. Please chant.
Pashandapata Vishamyam
Pashandapata Vaishamyam
Pratiloma Niveshanam
Pratiloma Niveshanam
Jivasya Gataya Yascha
Jivasya Gataya Yascha
Yavati Guna Karmaja
Yavati Guna Karmaja.
Vasanda Pata Vaishamyam
Vasanda Pata Vaishamyam
Pratiloma Niveshanam
Pratiloma Niveshanam
Jivasya Gatayo Yascha
Jivasya Gatayo Yascha
Yavati Guna Kamaja
Yavati Guna Karmaja.
Vasanda Pata Vishamyam
Vasanda Pata Vishamyam
Pratiloma Niveshanam
Pratiloma Niveshanam
Jivasya Gatayo Yascha
Jivasya Gatayo Yascha
Yavatir Guna Karmaja
Yavatir Guna Karmaja.
Prashanda Pata Vaishamyam
Prashanda Pata Vaishamyam
Pratiloma Niveshanam
Pratiloma Niveshanam
Jivasya Gatayo Yasya Cha
Jivasya Gatayo Yascha
Yavati Guna Kamaja
Yavati Guna Kamaja.
Ladies,
Prashanda Pata Vaishamyam
Pratiloma Niveshanam
Pratiloma Niveshanam
Jivasya Gatayo Yascha
Jivasya Gatayo Yascha
Yavati Guna Karmaja
Yavati Guna Karmaja.
Pashanda Pata
Pashanda Pata
The path of the faithless
The path of the faithless
Vaishamyam
Vaishamyam
Imperfection by contradiction
Imperfection by contradiction
Pratiloma
Pratiloma
Crossbreeding. Niveshanam. Situation. Jivasya. Of the living entities. Gatayaha. Movements. Yaha. As they are. Cha. Also. Yavatihi. As many as. Guna. Modes of material nature. Karmajaha. Generated by different work. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Please also describe the imperfections and contradictions of the faithless atheists, the situation of crossbreeding, and the movements of the living entities in various species of life according to their particular modes of nature and work. Purport. The combination of living entities in different modes of material nature is called crossbreeding. The faithless atheists do not believe in the existence of God, and thus their paths of philosophy are contradictory. Atheistic philosophies never agree with one another. Different species of life are evidence of varieties of mixtures of the modes of material nature. Pashanda patavaishamyam pratiloma niveshanam jivasya gatayo yascha yavatirguna karma jaha. Please also describe the imperfections and contradictions of the faithless atheists, the situation of crossbreeding, and the movements of the living entities in various species of life according to their particular modes of nature and work. So if the Bhagavatam is the personality of Godhead, what part of the body of the Lord is being described here? Atheists, improper, mixing the back of the Lord. Of course, the back of the Lord is also very beautiful. And though this is our meditation on the back of the Lord, and it's very important to understand what is the nature of evil. Krishna dedicates an entire chapter in the Bhagavad Gita. Of course, you can say it's divine and demoniac nature, but he finishes with a divine in the first three verses, and then the rest of that chapter is about the demoniac. And we have also whole sections of the Bhagavatam, whole chapters, the forest of material enjoyment, the story of King Puranjana, the hellish plans. We have whole sections that are dedicated to understanding evil. And why do we need to understand evil? We talked about this a little bit yesterday. One needs to know vidya and avidya. One needs to know sambhuti and asambhuti. We need to know both. Right. If someone's addicted to heroin, they need to understand not only healthy life, but the nature of their addiction also. Correct? Yes?
Yes.
Okay. So we will assume that all of us have some evil in us. Is that a reasonably safe assumption?
Yes.
All right. And if you say, I have no evil in me, then my answer is, what are you doing with this body? Unless you've come from Goloka to preach. But unless we've come from Goloka to preach, this body is evidence that there is evil tendencies in us. So here we're looking at three aspects of these evil tendencies. One is very broad. The last one is very broad. So, and the middle one is very narrow and specific. And the three we're looking at is the contradictory illogic of the atheists, improper marriage, improper relationships, and then finally just the general cycle of karma. So that's that last one is... The last one is it's really stuck. Okay, it's like glued to the floor. Okay. That's how I feel often in my life, that I'm just glued to the floor. Okay, and then the last one is very broad. So we'll look at each of these in turn. Now, we don't have that much time. Each of these could be discussed for many, many months. I taught a course for our secondary students called The Vedas in Modern Science. And in that one, we looked at these contradictory theories of the atheists, and we spent several months just looking at that. What to speak of the movements of the living entities through karma, the last one. We could also, again, spend many, many months on that. And improper association, we could certainly spend quite some time on that. So that we're just touching these things today. Please don't think that this is exhaustive. So, pasanta, pashanda patta vaishamyam, the contradictions of the atheists. So the atheists today are represented mostly by the scientists and the evolutionists, and to some extent by the impersonalists, but primarily the scientists and the evolutionists, who say that we are nothing but matter, we are simply material beings, that the whole reason anything exists is some sort of chance, some sort of randomness with no intelligence. There's no meaning to anything. Basically, what they are saying is life has absolutely no meaning whatsoever. That all of existence has no basis in anything that's true, and we're just a temporary machine. There's no such thing really as the self. And they also say there's no such thing as good. The Darwinian philosophy is survival of the fittest through intense competition. So that's rather nasty, isn't it? Isn't that nasty? If the way that things get better is through intense competition and you try to make your competitors die, that is exactly what Krishna describes as a demoniac mentality. You know, so many of my enemies have been killed in the past and I'll kill more in the future. And to have your gene pool survive. Isn't that the whole basis of all the wars between countries and races? And let my gene pool survive and let all the other genetic combinations be knocked out because I am superior. So isn't this contradictory with the kind of world that we all would like to live in? So what these atheists are saying, not all scientists are atheists, but what the atheistic scientists are saying, is they're saying the ultimate view of reality is one that's completely contradictory to the way that they want us to behave. Then they have programs about values and caring and compassion. Why should you have compassion? Right? With that worldview, should you have any compassion? The more compassion you have, the less things are going to evolve towards the good. And the Nazi philosophy was very much in keeping with evolution. Of course, they have to decide who's the best, and they decide that they're the best, because everybody decides that they're the best, yes? Everyone thinks that they're the best. My type is the best. So that would make sense, right? Every society become like the Nazis. Our type is the best, and let's kill all the other types. And then we'll be survival of the fittest. And that's the kind of world we would have. More or less, that is the kind of world that we have. But then there's also all this propaganda, you know, of taking care of the handicapped. Why should we take care of the handicapped? They're, you know, genetic defects. We should let them die. Does that make sense? And why should we search for meaning in our life? There is no meaning in life. The search for meaning is a joke. If the origin is nothing, and from this nothing somehow a chunk appeared, and if this chunk for no particular reason exploded, and if this explosion for no particular reason created all the planets and the stars, and if some, you know, chemical soup just by some electrical storm happened to wake up and reproduce, and somehow through genetic mutations over billions of years, human beings appeared, and were really nothing other than, you know, a bunch of monkeys, why should we search for meaning? There is no meaning. There's no meaning to anything. And I'm just a machine. All of my emotions are just simply chemicals. All I am is just some random chemicals. And why I'm born in a poor family and you're born in a rich family and I'm born ugly and you're born beautiful and I'm born with a 50 IQ and you're born with 150 IQ is just chance. And my parents are criminals and your parents are scholars and it's all random. Why try to skew any meaning out of life? It all becomes absurd. Even if one tries to skew meaning in a small way of, you know, I love my dog, and therefore my life is meaningful. Jai Dorjumar has just produced this book on the Bible book, Ecclesiastes, which is basically saying life has no meaning. And I was talking with him about how people ascribe meaning to their life. As I sent him an article about these people who ran a hotel, and they said, what we liked about running the hotel is it gave our life meaning. Now, according to the modern scientists, it's completely laughable. And the most laughable thing to them is to try to find meaning in religion. That to them is the most absurd conclusion. But we want meaning. Every human being is aching for meaning and value in life. And we enjoy being nice to each other. We enjoy helping those who are less fortunate. We don't want to kill everybody who's less fortunate than we are. What a world would that be? It would be hell. So therefore, their philosophy is full of contradictions. The essential nature of their philosophy is contradictory. That what they are saying is the nature of reality is at complete and total odds with how they then tell us to live. Be nice to everybody and really care and strive for meaning in your life and become all you can be and live a full life. But there's no meaning. And the way to get better and better is to, you know, grab all the resources that you can from those who are less capable. Strange, isn't it? Of course, because this is the prevailing philosophy, many people do try to live like that. Many people try to grab as many resources from the less fortunate as they possibly can. Yes, this is the whole concept of evolution. And, of course, within their philosophy, there's lots and lots of contradictions, which we don't have time to get into now. There's a really nice book by a scientist, Michael Bebe, called Darwin's Black Box. And in there, he explores a lot of the inherent contradictions in these atheistic theories. How they're saying that the bodies can evolve through genetic mutations, but it's not possible with what we know of genetics, with what we know of how the bodies work. So one area of science is contradicting another area of science. And he makes a very nice point that people, that scientists in various disciplines, they know that evolution doesn't make sense in their discipline. They all know that. But they're assuming, because there's not much interdisciplinary communication, they're assuming that evolution must make sense in the other disciplines. And they don't get together and talk about it and realize that the theory of evolution contradicts every other thing that's known about science. Just like there's a law of entropy. The law of entropy is that things tend to get worse and worse. That's our experience, right? I mean, you buy a car, and as soon as you drive the car out of the lot, it's depreciated in value. You all know that, right? Immediately, it's depreciated in value as soon as you drive it home. And yet they're saying everything gets materially better and better and better. But it's opposite. So they have two scientific theories that are opposite to each other. And there's another nice book that Vyasaki Prabhu just wrote, it's called Cosmology on Trial, where he talks about a lot of the contradictions in modern science. And the thing that struck me most in that book was gravity. How what we're taught about gravity in elementary school or even secondary school is just not true. That modern scientists don't really understand what gravity is, and that the universe works in the opposite way as to the way the theory of gravity would predict that it would work. Isn't that fascinating? So they have a theory of gravity that has certain predictions about the way the universe works, and the universe works in the opposite way. And then they go on teaching the same theory to children and the general public. And this is our theory. But they know that it doesn't make sense. Another interesting thing I saw with science is that, you know, when you're going through school, you're in primary school, secondary school, undergraduate, master's degree, they tell you that empirical science is the way to get knowledge. Right? Are we all told that? If you really want to get knowledge, you follow empiricism. You all know what empiricism is? The scientific method, you all remember that when you were like in fourth year of school? So that's you make observations with your senses, primarily your eyes, but also your ears and touch and smell and so forth. Based on those observations, you come up with some theory, use your logic and your mind, so pratyaksha anuman, to come up with some theory, and then you take that, or hypothesis rather, you take that hypothesis and you test it. And if as many different people test that hypothesis and they all find out that it holds, then it becomes a theory. And if the theory goes through more testing and they all find out it holds, it becomes a law. Right? We all remember being taught this?
Yeah.
And that the way it works is that we learn something of what's going on, and then as more information comes in through observation, we expand our hypotheses and our theories and our laws so that gradually we know more and more and more of reality. You all remember being taught this? Mm-hmm. Okay, you get up to the PhD, elementary school, you know, elementary, primary school, secondary, high school, undergraduate, master's, that's what they teach you. You know what? You get into the PhD program and you go into a class called the Philosophy of Science. And the first thing they tell you is, that's all a lie. It's really fascinating. You know, I was sitting there going, wow. They tell you why getting knowledge in that way doesn't yield anything called knowledge. First of all, they have you read Kuhn's The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, which if you're inclined towards this area of preaching, I would suggest that you read with a study guide. Don't try to read it without a study guide, which are available for free on the internet. And he talks about that modern science isn't increasing its knowledge. Modern science is just looking at different parts of knowledge at different times. He said they have certain theories that have that are working within a particular paradigm. It would be like, so the border of my sari, it has a pattern. And it's like if you were looked at one part of the pattern, and then you notice something from another part of the pattern that doesn't match, like this is a lighter color. So you'd say, oh, the sari is made of this color. And then you see there's light things. And then instead of enlarging, you switch and you then look at this part. And then you can't explain over here. Or like the six men with the elephant, you all know that story? So that's what science is actually like. Science is explaining the ear, and then they're explaining the tail, and then they're explaining the leg, but they're never explaining all of it. And he says there's these huge jumps in scientific paradigms when the evidences of things that are counter to the paradigms build up such that they cannot be ignored. Then science has a paradigm shift. And they simply shift to a new paradigm and they abandon the old paradigm. Although that old paradigm may still exist in some circles. So they're not enlarging their view of reality, they're simply changing their view of reality. And whatever they look at, there are certain things that they cannot explain. And there's always more that they can't explain than that they can explain. So I'm sure you know that the astronomers say we are only able to perceive 5% of the existing matter in the universe. Now, by the way, if we're only able to perceive 5%, how do we even know it's 5%? If you don't know what the total is, how can you say what percent you know? Do you follow that logic? Like, I wanted to research the result of all the children who went to Gurukula, how they turned out. But nobody knows how many children went to Gurukula. There's no records. So we have no idea. Was it 1,000? Was it 3,000? So let's say I survey 200. What percentage of the total am I getting? I don't have any idea because I don't know what the total is. So they're saying we estimate we can see 5% of the matter in the universe, but if you can't see the other, how do you know? So they're not getting more and more truth. They're getting different truths. They're not expanding their knowledge. Then on the other points, so the empirical method can only tell you what's not false. It can never give you anything approximating truth. It can never give you anything approximating truth. It can only say that in the instances we have examined, we have not found a counterexample. Like the example that, you know, everyone dies, but you haven't examined everyone. First of all, I don't know for sure that everybody living now is going to die. Maybe some of you will never die. Dhruva Maharaj didn't exactly die, did he? Did he? He didn't really undergo something that we would call death. So maybe someone here isn't going to die. Or maybe there's some person on the earth who's never died. I mean, I don't know. You can't find everybody. So all you can say is, so far, it's not false. But you can never say absolutely it's true. In order to say absolutely it's true, you would have to see every possible instance. And you never know if you see every possible instance, because you don't know what every possible instance is. So you don't even know what percentage of truthfulness you have. Are you all following this again? What to speak of all over the universe, all we can look at are the laws that we can perceive on this planet. To make the assumption that the laws of nature act exactly the same way on Jupiter is rather proud, isn't it? A lot of hubris. That the laws of chemistry, physics, and mathematics operate the same way on Jupiter. I just read an interesting article how the scientists, they determine whether or not a planet can sustain life by whether or not it contains water. Because they consider that water is essential for life. And the author was saying, but maybe water is essential for life on this planet in the form that we know it, and maybe it's other chemicals and other liquids that would sustain very different kinds of life. You know, we're making an assumption that everything is the way that we think it is. Another problem with empiricism is that empiricism is affected by our personal biases. And I don't really have time to get into this, but even the scientists will say that what we perceive is more a matter of what we believe. It's our beliefs that come first and then our perceptions. Our perceptions do not really inform our beliefs. Our beliefs inform our perceptions. And a simple example of this is the very, very famous card experiment done in the 1940s, where people were shown, you all know that everyone's familiar with playing cards? Hearts, diamonds, spades, and clubs, right? So they added some anomalous cards. They added like red spades, black diamonds. And they showed these cards to the subjects in the experiment very quickly and asked them to identify the cards. So when they saw them very quickly, they would see the red spade, and either they'd say it was a heart or a spade. They'd put it into their existing categories. You all following them? They wouldn't see that it was something outside of their expectations. And gradually they slowed down the speed at which they showed the cards. And very gradually, most people started, at one point they'd say, oh, what's that? But a certain percentage of the people, no matter how slowly they were shown the cards, never recognized the anomalous cards. They never recognized something outside of their existing categories. And this is, my dear friends, how we all function. So we are interpreting data, and our interpretations of data are never the same as the data. We all know this as devotees, although we may not apply it to ourselves. You know, we may think how I perceive reality is reality. But if I have imperfect senses and a tendency to cheat and a tendency to be illusion, etc., there's no way that the reality that I'm experiencing is reality. I'm experiencing my interpretation of reality, which is why three people experiencing the same thing will not describe it the same way. It's one of the main causes of arguments between people. Well, this happened. No, it wasn't. This is what happened. And, well, we were in the same room at the same time. Then another problem is we not only perceive through a personal bias, we perceive through a cultural bias. What we consider to be right and wrong and good and bad and how we interpret things depends to a large extent on our culture. This is one of the big problems that we're having more and more with some of the cultural statements that Srila Prabhupada made. That as the culture is changing, people perceive his statements very differently. I don't want to be explicit, but children who are born and raised now will have a very different view of marriage than we do. They just will. And they're going to view the Shastric statements very differently. So we have these cultural biases. Also, there's an unlimited number of stories you can tell about the same evidence. This is why it's so hard to find out who did it in a crime. Right? I'm sure we've all like seen or read a mystery story where you really think this person did it, and in the end someone else did it. Right? And it happens in real life in crime that there's all the evidence and two detectives have a very different story. Or they go to trial and this is the story and it turns out they're wrong and they find out 10 years later somebody else did it. There's an unlimited amount of stories you can tell about the same evidence, and those stories, they're affected by our individual and cultural biases. Then another problem is that correlation does not imply causation. For example, when there's a fire truck. There's a correlation, there's a relationship between fires and fire engines, but there's not causation. fires do not create fire engines, nor do fire engines create fires. So the fact that two things happen in some relationship with each other does not imply causation. So these are the problems with empiricism that they teach you at the PhD level, and then they go around saying, empiricism is the way to knowledge. So these are contradictions. So we've just touched on the contradictions of the atheists. You can go into this, as I say, we could spend many, many months studying the contradictions of the atheists. So now we're going to go on to pratiloma niveshanam. Oh, we should also say, with the contradictions of the atheists, because as we said in the beginning, all of us have some evil in us. If we have evil in us, that means that we are justifying our evil in a way that is in contradiction to the rest of what we say that we believe. Did you all follow that? It's duplicity. It's a cheating propensity. So just like the evolutionists, they're saying life has no intrinsic meaning, but find meaning in your life. The way things get better is by ruthless competition and death. But be kind and compassionate and help those who are less fortunate. Do you understand that? Okay, if we have evil in us, then guess what? We are all doing the same thing. We're espousing in ourselves two contradictory philosophies. We're espousing one philosophy that says what we believe in and what we aspire to be, and then we espouse another philosophy to justify the evil that we are still doing to ourselves and others. I'll give you a very simple example of that. When I was an administrator in a public school, in a government school, so Americans have this holiday called Thanksgiving, where they thank God for their benedictions in life, and they usually eat turkeys. It's one of the main things they do, is they eat turkey. The turkey is almost the symbol of Thanksgiving. Two symbols of Thanksgiving. The cornucopia, the horn of plenty. You all know what that is? It's like a big basket filled with fruit and vegetables. And from the harvest, it's a harvest festival. And a turkey. Those are the two symbols of the holiday. Now, every culture, unless they don't have seasons, has a harvest festival. What's our harvest festival, by the way? We have a harvest festival in the Hare Krishna. Govardhan Puja. Is our harvest festival? Basant Panchami. It's spring. That's the beginning of the harvest. Oh. Harvest festival. So it was interesting on Thanksgiving. You know, you go into the classrooms, and the children were being told stories about turkeys who escape. The turkey who doesn't get killed. The turkey that runs away from the butcher. The turkey that runs away from the cook. And they're all cheering for the turkey that runs away. And then they go in the cafeteria and they eat a turkey. And the children's storybooks are full of examples where the prey animal escapes from the predator animal. The rabbit gets away from the tiger, except if they were an insect. They didn't mind insects being eaten. But any other prey animal would never get caught. It was always the tiger that went hungry, or the Tyrannosaurus Rex that went hungry, and the Brontosaurus baby was safe. And then they would go and eat meat. So this is also the way the atheists have these contradictions. Oh, we are kind. We are. This is. You ever really thought why it's so hard to talk to meat eaters about being kind to animals? I say, well, I'm kind to animals, because they're trained like that as children, that I'm kind to animals and eat them at the same time. They disconnect. So we all do that. We all do that. We are cruel to ourselves. We are cruel to others. We are offensive to others, and we say, I'm a very nice and kind person. And we have those things in like separate rooms, and they don't talk to each other. All right, going on to pratiloma niveshanam. Pratiloma is about, ultimately about bad association. It's about high-class people who get dragged down by low-class people. Technically, pratiloma refers to the marriage of a high-class woman to a low-class man. So generally in the shastras, men and women should marry who are of the same nature. Krishna makes this point to Rukmini, that people of equal nature should marry. And of course, nature, guna and karma, is determined by how you have your livelihood. And how you have your livelihood is determined by the particular combination of the modes of nature. So a very important subcategory here is that the shastras very clearly say that both men and women have varna. Because there's no meaning to the word pratiloma unless both men and women have varna. the concept among certain circles, even in the Hare Krishna movement, that only men have varna and women do not, is not, does not have any shastric support. There'd be no meaning to saying that there should be marriage between varna. And when different varnas marry, the woman does not become the man's varna. It's considered an anuloma or a pratiloma marriage. Just like Roma Harshan Sutta was the product of a pratiloma marriage. His mother was a brahmana and his father was a kshatriya. So she did not become a kshatriya by marrying him. She stayed a brahmani. And therefore the children were considered mixed. And mixed in not a good way. Now when it's anuloma, when the man is of a higher varna than the woman, that's acceptable. That's anuloma. But when the woman is higher, that's pratiloma. That's unacceptable. Right, and we have, that's why Yayati said he didn't want to marry Devayani. He said, you are of a higher varna. Now, the varna of people is not determined by birth. Yes, we know this. Chaturvarnya mayashristam guna karma vibhagashaha. And that would mean that it's not determined by birth either for men or for women. There's not an additional verse in the Bhagavad Gita that for women it's janma. Because sometimes people say, well, women have varna, but it's just their family. It means one's quality and one's work. So this would mean that women have both the qualities of the different varnas and, oh my goodness, work in the different varnas. It would have to be, because that's what Krishna says. He says qualities and work, which means that women have varna, and varna is livelihood, which means that women traditionally had careers. And we see this practically. We see that the Brahmin women were essential to the yajna. The men could not perform the yajnas without their wives. The Kshatriya women were helping rule the kingdom, like Draupadi. The Vaishya women were selling their milk products, right? Or selling their fruit, like the fruit vendor. The Shudra women were doing the music and the dance and the weaving and the pottery and so forth, along with the men. So why is it worse if the woman is of a higher nature and okay if the man is of a higher nature? Because by male-female psychology, the man wants to be the leader. It's natural that the man wants to be the leader and protector, and it's natural that the woman wants to be the follower. That is natural. When you have a relationship between a man and a woman where that's reversed, it doesn't work very well. Or if they try to be equal leaders, that doesn't work very well either. The most unstable relationships in this world are equal partnerships, as far as business goes. So because the man is the natural leader and the woman is the natural follower, and the woman is supposed to follow her husband's vows and her husband's mentality, if he's of a lower nature than her, she'll be pulled down. If he's of a higher nature than her, she can be pulled up. Now, that doesn't always happen. When Ajamyo married a woman, well, he didn't really marry, he had a common law marriage. When he left his equal wife and he became the common law husband of a woman who was lower, she was not raised to his level, rather he was dragged down to her level. So even the anuloma marriages are discouraged. They're discouraged because the man may not be able to bring the wife up to his level. Again, it's by quality. Like Devahuti was born in a kshatriya family, but she was by nature a Brahmin. She had the same nature, because that's what Kardama Muni asked for. You remember, he asked the Lord, please give me a woman of the same nature. So it means although she had a lower family, she was actually of a higher nature. So in our association, we should be very, very careful that most of our association is with equals, and that we have our most intimate relationship with equals, and particularly that we never put ourselves in a position where someone who's of a lower nature than us has authority over us. We should never have ourselves in a position where we are under the authority and under the control of somebody with a lower nature to ourselves. This is very dangerous. And this is, I understand, one of the main reasons why the Brahmins, Kshatriyas, and Vaishyas would have an independent livelihood. They would not work for somebody else. Because as soon as you work for somebody else, then immediately you have to compromise your nature to please that person. Just like the modern brahmanas, the modern scientists and researchers, they're mostly in the employ of government or business, which means they're under the employ of corrupt kshatriyas and corrupt vaishyas. And then they cannot display their brahminical qualities. Often the government is under the control of business, which means the government cannot properly protect the citizens. Often the business is under the control of the workers, which means the business cannot properly protect the natural resources and the animals. So the Brahmanas are supposed to protect truth, the Kshatriyas are supposed to protect people, the Vaishyas are supposed to protect the natural resources and the animals, and the Shudras are supposed to protect the arts and the skills and the crafts. The Brahmanas are supposed to produce wisdom, the Kshatriyas are supposed to produce care and peace, the Vaishyas are supposed to produce natural, honest wealth, and the Shudras produce all the beauty and function in society. So they cannot do that if they put themselves under the control of someone who's lower than them. So we should be very, very careful of this in our life. Otherwise, we end up in a pratiloma situation, and the fruits, the children of those unions will be bad. The children are disturbed. When the mother is of a higher nature than the father, the children do not turn out very well. So the fruit, the children are considered to be the fruit of marriage. Two fruits of marriage, good population and honest wealth in your varna. So if you're a Brahmin, your honest wealth is the wealth of knowledge. If you're a Kshatriya, your honest wealth is the wealth of care. If you're a Vaishya, your honest wealth is actual money. If you're a Shudra, your honest wealth is, again, the arts and the crafts and the functions. But those cannot be done properly if someone is being dragged down. When the woman is dragged down, not only does it degrade her, but it prevents the children from being of a high quality. So if we allow ourselves to be dragged down, the fruit will not be very good. All right, going on to the last one, which is a huge, 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 huge. Jiva gatayo yascha yavatir guna karma cha, which reminds us of the Bhagavad Gita verse, which has now just popped out of my mind. Karmana guna sangasya sadasad yoni janamasu. That we take our births according to our association with the modes of material nature. So this is, of course, the movements of the living entities, which is going to be described a little bit later by Lord Kapila Dev. How, in our forgetfulness of Krishna, we move through so many species of life according to the modes that we have accepted, according to the modes with which we associate. And you can think of it something like if you go into a bookstore, you know, there's the philosophy section, there's the romance section, there's the horror section, right? And which section of the bookstore you go to, you'll then pick up a book there and you become immersed in that story. Correct? Or, you know, some multiplex cinema where they play, you know, 10, 15 movies. And again, there's the nature show, there's the romance comedy, there's the action, there's the whatever, the horror movie, whatever. And you're going to, you go to a certain section, oh, I want to see that kind of movie, I want to read that kind of book. And then you go there, you're reading it, you're watching it, and you become absorbed in it as if it was you. It becomes your story. You enter into it. And that's why people read books and watch movies, because they want to do that. You don't want to sit in the theater thinking, it's just a bunch of flashing lights and actors, you know. And just the imaginations of the author. So a person wants to enter into it and make it theirs so that they're experiencing the story as if it's their own. So that's exactly what we're doing in our traveling through the different species of life. We get attracted to particular modes of nature, and that particular modes of nature weaves a story for us and creates a character for us. I was just reading in Gopal Champu, really interesting, about how Krishna and Balaram recover the dead son of their guru, Sandipani Muni, and how first they go into the ocean to the demon Panchajanya, and there Krishna takes the conch shell for his own, but he doesn't find any trace of the body there. And he explains to Yamaraj, he said, I didn't find any bit of the body there, so I came here to find the soul to your kingdom. And Yamaraj says, well, this soul has been suffering for his very sinful karma. He said, but if they want back the son of their own son, they're going to want back the same body. He said, but that body's gone. He said, I don't even know what it was anymore. It's just gone. He said, we'll have to try to recreate it. And he weaves together the modes of nature in a certain set of ingredients. You know, it's just like you go in the kitchen. And you have. I remember when I first had a sandesh, I was a professional baker previously, and I had my first sandesh. I'm like, what is this? You know, in the West, we don't have any sweet like that. Oh, you know, what is this? The devotees gave it to me when I was going to work, and so all day I was meditating on this sandesh, and I came back to the temple, and I'm like, what is that? They said, milk and sugar. I'm like, come on. no way. Of course, I was tasting Krishna. I wasn't just tasting the material ingredients, but I said, no way, milk and sugar. They said, well, a little lemon juice. Oh, that must be it. Okay. But it's the simple ingredients. You know, you can take butter, sugar, and flour. And you, how many things can you make out of just a few ingredients? Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of things. You know, or butter, salt, and flour. Or rice. You know, I remember the first time I went to South India, I went to Kerala. And, you know, they put this prasadam. What's this? This is rice with tamarind. Okay. What's this? Yogurt and coconut and tamarind. Or what's this? Rice and coconut. Or what's this? Rice, coconut, tamarind. You know, just the three ingredients. Everything was rice, coconut, and tamarind. And all these different things that they would make. Or in China, it was even more extreme. You know, you look at something, oh, that's a samosa. Oh, no, no, it's sticky rice. Okay, okay. Oh, what's this? This looks like halva. No, no, sticky rice. Okay. Oh, this is cake. No, sticky rice. It was really bizarre. It's like 90% of the preparations were just, you know, all tasted the same to it all. Looked different, you know, different shapes, and they have different colors or something they put in, you know. I thought it was halva with raisins. It was sticky rice with beans, you know. So one can take the modes of nature and put them in all these different permutations, and they look different. They're actually all the same. Really, the only rasa you get in the material world is cardboard. You know, cardboard. There's no taste in material rasa. It's all just protons, neutrons, and electrons. It's all it is. It's just protons, neutrons, and electrons. There's no taste at all. Nothing. Zero. Zippo. Nothing. Chewing the chewed. Old gum. But they combine in different ways and enchant us, and they look like the spiritual varieties. They're reflections of the spiritual varieties. And we think, oh, I know that. That was tasty. You know? That's halva with raisins. Oh, sticky rice. No salt. No taste. So a living entity is just trying, you know. It's like looking, you know, and, oh, that looks good. I'll try that one. Oh, that looks good. I'll try that one. And you get to it. Ugh, oh, there's no taste. Oh, that one looks good. That one looks good. I know what that tastes like. Oh, no taste. And then you try another. And then try another one. And finally you wake up and become intelligent and said, maybe I'm going to the wrong store. Maybe I'm shopping in the illusion mart. Maybe everything here is an illusion. Maybe there's nothing here that's a reality. And so that is the movements of the living entities in various species. Let me try the tiger taste. Let me try the fish taste. Let me try the demigod taste. Let me try the male taste, the female taste. Female deer, male deer. You know, seahorse. The male seahorse actually becomes pregnant, you know. Try that. And as human beings, we try to get all of them in this life, isn't it? You notice that? We try to fly like a bird. We try to swim like a fish. We try to play like an otter. Even people try in this life, man, woman. But it's all cardboard. And it's just different combinations of the modes of nature. It's just a reflection. Whatever appears to be a value of it is without relation to me, has no reality, known to be my illusory energy, that reflection that appears to be in darkness. So we should learn from this and get our taste only in the reality, get our taste only in relation with Krishna. That's real. And there's actual varieties of tastes. And there one gets a form according not to the modes of nature, but according to one's flavor of love for Krishna. Each of us has a unique flavor of love for Krishna. It's not just that all the cowherd boys are all exactly alike. They each have their own. Rupa Goswami describes some subcategories as the older cowherd boys where it's Sakya mixed with Vatsalya, and the younger cowherd boys where it's Sakya mixed with Dasya. But then there's also varieties of intimacy and varieties. And sub. And Ujjala Nilamani, he gives hundreds of thousands of varieties of gopis. And, you know, sub, till you get to each of us, which we have our own unique relationship with Krishna. And Krishna displays a particular form and qualities, as Sanatana Goswami explained. That's just to reciprocate with us. So that's the real unlimited variety and the real unlimited variety of taste. And Krishna, Akila Rasamrita Murti, he is simultaneously tasting these unique combinations of tastes with each jiva. Just imagine. Akila Rasamrita Murti. So here we've understood something about evil, so we can recognize it. You need to recognize not only what's a plant, but what's a weed. The first time, this is so embarrassing, the first time I ever grew a garden, I had no idea what was a plant and what was a weed. I didn't even know how to plant things. I just went to the shop and bought some marigolds and zinnia seeds. Hare Krishna, this is so embarrassing. And I just, you know, my husband prepared a little plot of land, and then I just put the seeds in. And after a little while, my whole plot of land was covered with green stuff growing. Solid, like a solid blanket of green stuff. Because not only had all the little flowers grown up, but lots and lots and lots of weeds had grown up. And I couldn't tell. I wasn't experienced. I couldn't tell. I was just looking at the little green things, you know. What's the flower and what's the weed? And Rupa Goswami says that some of the weeds that grow up with the bhakti creeper look just like the bhakti creeper. You can really get confused. So it's essential that not only do we need to recognize Krishna, we need to recognize evil, we need to recognize illusion. And we talked about three things here: the contradictory philosophies of the atheists, the danger of being dragged down by bad association, and seeking our pleasure in the ever-changing illusion, which is just really a different semblances, but it's all the same. So instead of doing that, we should have the congruent, cogent philosophy of truth, where everything fits together and makes sense. We should choose association that will elevate us, and we should have a taste for the reality. So it is now 8:30, which is, I think, when we're supposed to end on a weekday. Is that correct? Maybe we could have 5 minutes for questions, or will that disturb your work?
No.
Anyone else here running off to work? You're going to ask a question, so I'll assume it's okay. So it's your dress to go to work. Yes?
With the varnas, they only work here on the spiritual world as well?
Oh, that's a very interesting question. In Brihad Bhagavatamrita, when Uddhava and Narada Muni are speaking to Gopakumar in Dwarka, so Narada Muni tells Uddhava, he said, you should explain to Gopakumar about Vrindavan because you go there. And Uddhava says, well, I can't because I'm a kshatriya and you're a brahmana. So you're superior, so you should do the explaining. And Narada Muni says, what are you talking about? We're in the spiritual world. There's no brahmana, kshatriya, vaishya-shudra here. There's no modes of nature. And Uddhava says, oh, Krishna likes to play like that even here. So there's something there of which there is the reflection.
How do we, with our varna, how do we pinpoint it, like where are we more, which varna are we actually?
Well, if you want to look in terms of varna, varna is really taking all the thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of careers. Oh, there's somebody hiding back there that I never saw the whole time. Where do I go? All of a sudden I see some orange peeking up. Cheers. So if you take all of the occupations one could possibly have, I don't know how many there are if you list all the occupations. The point of varna is whatever occupation you're doing should be done for the pleasure of the Lord. That's the point. So if someone says, well, how? I'm a cashier in a bank. How do I do that for Krishna? You know, I determine the train schedules. How do I do that for Krishna? So what the Shastra did, instead of having guidance for every single occupation, which changes, obviously the people running the train schedules didn't exist when the Bhagavatam was written. So instead of doing it that way, you know, it would be an awfully long book, how to offer each of those occupations to Krishna. They divided them into four categories of occupation. And each of those four categories has a particular type of enjoyment, sensory, mental enjoyment, and a particular way of being offered in sacrifice to Krishna. So that's the reason why we even have these categories of varnas for simplicity. Now remember, whenever there's simplicity, there's also distortion. When you really oversimplify things, when you take, you know, hundreds of thousands of occupations and you try to put them into four categories, there's going to be a little distortion. And especially some of our modern occupations were not even considered. So some of them are going to fit in more than one category. And that's even true in the original varnas. You know, for example, you could have a Shudra who has his own business. In Govardhan town, there's this one man who fixes shoes. And most of the shoes people wear, I don't know what you call them here, thongs, flip-flops, what do you call them?
Thongs.
Most of them are just these cheap rubber thongs, which here in Australia, I assume nobody fixes. They probably only cost a couple dollars for the cheap ones. And I'm sure when they're finished, you just throw them away. But in Govardhan town, you fix them. And you take them to this little guy. Now, he doesn't even have a shop. He has a piece of cardboard. Really, that's what he has. He has a piece of cardboard, and he puts it. And unlike in Western countries where the police will cart you away for putting down a piece of cardboard on the side of the road, you know, you're not paying your taxes. Where's your license to have a, you know, your street vendor license? In New York, there's street vendors, but they all display their license. But this thong fixer, he doesn't have a license. He just has a piece of cardboard. Nobody harasses him. He just has a piece of cardboard, and he has his little toolbox, and that's what he does. So he's a Shudra, yes? Definitely he's a Shudra. But he's a pretty high-level Shudra. Look, he's independent. Isn't he? He has no boss. He sets his own hours. He chooses his own location. He sets his own hours. He decides what customers he's going to get. You follow?
Yeah.
Yes? So if we think that all the Shudras are like, you know, ditch diggers with a foreman yelling at them, we'll miss the point. So some Shudras have their own business. That doesn't make them a Vaishya because they have their own business. So what delineates the four? The Brahmanas are creators of wisdom. They are creating wisdom and knowledge and guidance in the society. And their yajna is to protect wisdom, knowledge, and guidance in the society, which is one reason the Brahmins had debates. Within each varna, there's a competition to protect the purity. So how do they do their yajna? They make sure that they're not financially beholden to anyone. They keep themselves in a state of poverty, so they're not going to be influenced by greed and a desire for someone else to maintain them. Right? They live a very simple life, so keep their consciousness pure so that they will understand what is wisdom. They make sure they get the wisdom from the Shastra, not from their own. So this is their dharma. Then you have the Kshatriyas. The Kshatriyas' main business is not swords and guns. The Kshatriyas' main business is care and protection. Even, I don't know what it is in this country. I don't think you allow, do you allow your police officers to have guns here?
Yeah.
You do. Mm-hmm. I know in America, only 10% of police officers have ever fired a gun at a human being. So even though they're the police officers, their main business is not violence, their main business is care and protection. What to speak of people in government who aren't police officers and directly on the battlefield? The main job of the Kshatriya, and probably the landlord is also Kshatriya, these are people whose main interest is people. They want to provide people with food, clothing, medical, water, electricity, education, roads. They want to take care of people. They kind of have the mood of a super parent. And what is their dharma? What is their yajna? Their yajna is they have to be willing to go fight. They have to be willing to go on the battlefield. They have to be willing to be the first on the battlefield. And the other yajna is they put the good of the people over their own people, over their own good, even if it means banishing your wife to the forest when she's pregnant. You know, you have to take care of the citizens to that extent that you sacrifice your own. And you train the citizens according to the Brahmanas. You protect the Brahmanas. You don't exploit them, you don't try to own them, and you let the Brahmanas guide the citizens in yajna. You use a big portion of the tax money for yajna. You don't use all the tax money just for material care in your own palace. You set aside some portion for yajna and you train the people in spiritual principles. You don't train them that you're God like Vena did. You train them that God is God. Okay, then the Vaishyas, their area is the wealth. They're supposed to create, generate natural wealth. They're the only people creating wealth in the society. And they're supposed to increase that wealth. So they're, and it's supposed to be honest wealth. Their sacrifice is the wealth has to be honest. It has to be real wealth. It can't just be numbers on a computer screen. It's got to be real, something of substance. The wealth itself has to be something of substance. Then it has to be generated in honest means, not through pouring chemicals into the earth or pouring hormones into the cows. And their yajna also is they have to protect the sources of wealth. They have to protect the land, the sky, the water, and the animals, so that the wealth generation can go on generation after generation, not that they suck everything dry in artificial means, and then the next generation has no wealth. And they have to use that wealth also in charity and in jagu. Everyone has to give charity. The Brahmins have to distribute in charity whatever they don't need. The Kshatriyas have to distribute charity also as part of their care of the people. The Vaishyas also have to distribute charity for sacrifice. They have to use their wealth for the sacrifice for Vishnu. So they have to take care of Vishnu's wife, which is the earth, and they have to take care of Vishnu's pets, which are the animals. So they're taking care of Vishnu's wife and taking care of Krishna's pets, and they're also giving a sacrifice for Vishnu. Then the Shudras, they're in charge of all the beauty and the function in society. They're in charge of the fabrics, they're in charge of the building materials in the houses, the gardens, the upkeep of the roads, the production of furniture, all the arts, the music, the painting, the dancing, everything that creates beauty in society is under the control of the Vaishyas. And also the function. Does the garbage get picked up? Does the water run? You know, that kind of thing. Do your appliances work? You know, so they're in charge of all of that, and that's their area. And their yajna is to keep those things as skills and crafts, not like the factories. In the factories, there's no skill or craft involved in. They have to preserve the craft of it, which gives the Sudras a sense of accomplishment. They also have to make sure that the arts and functions of society are elevating people and bringing them closer to Vishnu. They have to produce furniture and paintings and music and everything in such a way that reminds people of the Lord, that doesn't take people away from the Lord. And the pleasures they're supposed to provide are pious pleasures. And they have to ensure that whatever they're enjoying is within the realm of Dharma. So how do you know what your propensity is? Well, you see, what do I like to play with? Do I like to play with ideas? Do I like to play with care? Do I like to play with money? Or do I like to play with things? What's my fun? Where do I get my fun? What energizes me? What makes me feel alive?
Idea fold in the word category?
Brahmanas. The people who like to play with ideas and knowledge. Like, I love taking philosophical concepts and reordering them. I love doing that. I love taking them and putting them into categories and subcategories and ordering them and finding new meanings and new connections. I love doing that. I could do it for hours and hours and hours and hours and hours. And putting ideas with pictures and sounds. I create tons of multimedia presentations, you know. Right, take the ideas, and how do I represent the idea as a picture? How do I represent the idea as a sound? And how do I take the principle and the idea and relate it to something that people are actually grappling with in their life? And you know, and I haven't the slightest interest in, you know, going out and building hospitals and roads and fighting on battlefields. I don't care about money. And so, what do you like to play with? What do you like to play with? Like, I know one devotee who's a Vaishya, and he always talks about value in terms of money. You know, if he does some service, so he does a lot of service for some of our projects, and he'll say, you know, okay, it took me an hour and a half to do this, and, you know, that's worth $70. He's not asking for money. He's just saying, I just gave $70 worth of service. I never think like that. I don't think, well, I taught a Bhagavatam class, and see, it went on for an hour and a half. I don't think in terms of money, but he thinks in terms of money. So you need that. You need someone to generate wealth in society. Yes? What do you like to play with? What gives you excitement? What makes you feel alive? You can tell a lot of your natural talents by what do you do so easily that you're not even aware that you're doing it. If you, it's like breathing, and someone else has to come to you and say, you know, you're really good at that. I am. Isn't everybody? Until I became a teacher, I thought everybody could analyze things the way I do. And then when I became a teacher and I saw, well, most of the kids couldn't do that. No matter how I trained them, it didn't matter. I tried to train them all to do that, and they couldn't. And then I realized, oh, that I can do something that I can do. So each of us has, Prabhupada says, everyone has some extraordinary talent. And to serve Krishna with one's extraordinary talent means successful life. But often we don't see our extraordinary talent, because to us it's just breathing. Well, that's just what I do. You know, I make money. I just create wealth wherever I go. Or I just take care of people wherever I go. I'm taking care of people. Or I come to a place and I make it more beautiful. And I make sure everything's working. I say, oh man, that's not working. I'll fix it. Yeah, well, what do you do? And also, that's the kind of thing that you do spontaneously. You do it whether anybody asks you to do it or not. Nobody has to ask you. Just do it. You do it whether anybody pays you or not. You don't care if you get paid for it. It's irrelevant. Those are the two things. Things that you do so easily, it's like breathing, and things that you do unconditionally. You just do them. Now, those are what indicates your nature. And they make you feel alive. Like Ayurvedically, you know, modern medicine, there's one diet basically for everybody, unless you have some strange disease like celiac disease or, you know, diabetes. Basically, there's one healthy diet for everybody. But in Ayurveda, there's different healthy diets according to your nature. One man's food is another man's poison. Some people should eat ice cream, and some people shouldn't eat ice cream. And some people should eat potatoes, and other people shouldn't eat potatoes. Certain kinds of food will make each of us feel alive, and certain kinds of food will make us feel dead. You all have this experience? There's certain things you eat, you're like, I have to go to sleep for about 4 hours, and my mind doesn't work. And other kinds of food, you eat them, and you're like, okay, let's go conquer the world. So it's like that with activities, too. If you think about it, I'm sure all of us have certain activities that while we're doing it, you do it for 5 minutes, you're like, how long have I been doing this? Only 5 minutes? Seems like I'm doing it for an hour. Oh, this is interesting. Let me go look at this. All right, I guess I've got to go back to it. Okay, let me work on this again. Okay, I'm working. How long have I been working on this again? 5 minutes? Let me go do something else. Right? Do we all have things like that? And then you have certain things you're working on it, and like, oh my God, it's already 2 o'clock? I thought I was only working on this for 10 minutes. Time for prasadam. Yeah, I'll be there. Okay, let's do it. Five minutes. Prasadam's getting cold. Yeah, I'll be there. It's time to go to sleep. Yeah, whatever. Right? Do we have these two kinds of activities? Yeah, the kind of activities are, oh, let me go get a snack. And then we have the kind of activities where, forget about eating. Yes? That's how you know what your nature is. That's how you know what your nature is. What makes you feel alive? And don't look at just the superficial aspects. Look at the why. Why does this thing make you feel alive? What about it? You know, maybe you really feel alive designing a poster for an upcoming event. So does that mean that your whole life should be designing posters for upcoming events? So you want to get to the why. What about it? Maybe what we really enjoyed about it was that you worked with a team. Maybe you really enjoyed the artistic, creative aspect of it. Maybe you really enjoyed the research aspect of it. What parts of it did you enjoy? You find which parts of it you enjoyed, and then you put that together and you can figure out what your varna is. What we're supposed to, our ultimate perfection is when we fully realize who we are in our spiritual identity, our specific individual spiritual identity, and we use that to make Krishna happy. Is that a correct explanation of our Siddhanta? Did I get that right? Yep. Did I get that right, everybody? Did you get that right? Okay. So in this world, we also have an identity. It's an illusory, temporary identity, but it still is our identity. So what we also do in this world is we find out what identity do I have in this life, and I use that to make Krishna happy. And that identity, it's going to be what is in sync with my body and mind. Now, by the way, that changes to some extent over the life cycle, Because we not only have varna, we have ashram. And varna is only done in what ashram? Because varna is how you earn your livelihood. Varna is how you earn your livelihood. It's only done in the grahastha ashram. The brahmacharis are not doing varna, they're preparing for varna. They're being trained in their varna. The vanaprasthas have retired from their varna, and the sannyasis are dead or preparing for death. So even in ordinary life, students, retired people, and dead people don't have a job. Correct? So anyone who wants to not marry, anyone who wants to skip the grahastha ashram, also has to skip varna. That's one of the symptoms for somebody qualified to skip the grahastha ashram. It is. It's one of the main qualifications. Can you skip varna? Can you skip wanting to use your psychophysical nature in the world as a way of maintaining yourself? Because vanaprastha and sannyasis are supposed to do just bhakti. No varna. A little side note. So that also changes. So even you have your varna, you get to a point around midlife where your varna doesn't have any juice in it anymore. Just like you reach a point at puberty where your toys have no juice. You all remember that? You reached a point at puberty where you got out your toys and there was no rasa in them? Yes? You all remember that? I remember getting out my dolls and trying to play with my dolls. I was like, this is dumb. Or maybe with you guys it was your cars or whatever. Your toy soldiers. And you get your building blocks, you know, and you get them out and you're like, huh? What did I ever see in this? So that also happens when you transition from grahastha to vanaprastha. First of all, the ashram things lose their sparkle. You lose your interest in that part of things. And you lose your interest in varna also. It's like, why do I want to earn a living? What a stupid thing to do. Why do I think I'm going to change the world? I'm going to affect the world. I'm going to do something in the world. I'm going to give wisdom to the world. I'm going to give care to the world. I'm going to give money to the world. I'm going to give beauty and fun. What a stupid, useless thing to do. How dumb. I can't do anything. So if you can come to that point right after the brahmacharya ashram, then you skip the grahastha ashram. But most people can't. Most people are like, I want to do something for the world. So, yeah, we do that. Is that all right? And that's good. Krishna wants people out there doing something for the world, by the way. That's also service. Don't think it's all nonsense. Krishna wants devotees who are running governments, and he wants devotees running businesses, and he wants devotees who are artists and musicians and actors, and he wants devotees as professors, and he wants that. That's valuable. But once when nature does change, the ashrams also change. And then one gets to a point where one's focus is just on preparing for death. It's like when you're a child, your focus is very narrow. And then as you grow, it expands, expands, expands. At the end of life, it again narrows. Yes? All right. We definitely should stop here. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.